My friends, welcome. This is part two of a conversation with David the Good about how to do survival gardening without a supply chain to get you all the things that you might think you need to grow a meaningful amount of food for your family. So if you missed part one, I'll have that posted below, and also you can find it on iceagefarmer.com/DTG. It was a great beginning of the conversation. It's a great end too. I apologize that it took me a little bit of time in between posting these. I didn't mean to keep you on the edge of your seat there for so long. It's just the way the cookie crumbled here. But I also considered making this second part like a Patreon-only thing, but I have never put any content behind a paywall, and I don't want to start now. That said, I do need your support to keep this show running, so if you value this information, if you appreciate this broadcast, please help me keep it running. You can do that on subscribestar.com/iceagefarmer, or on Patreon, or a few different ways like cryptos that I've listed at iceagefarmer.com/support. Now, let's get right to it. I want to thank David the Good again for taking the time to have this conversation. It's an important one. As you know, food prices are going crazy. Supply chain is in disarray. So what better time than 20 years ago, but failing that, than now, to start up your garden and be able to feed your family without depending on these brittle, crumbling systems. Let's get back to it.
And as you think about, you know, what do you want to plant, I've told people many times, you know, Don't just have your heart set on one variety of tomato, one variety of this, one variety of that, one variety of this. I said plant like four or five varieties of each thing, and then you figure out which one is more adapted to your climate. And one of the ways I do tell people to analyze what grows in my area, because somebody will write me from Arkansas and they'll be like, well, what should I plant in June? And I'm like, I could go research Arkansas. But really what will tell you what to plant in June is, okay, first of all, what commercial farms or operations have run in your area either now or historically, and what do they grow? Are there pecans in your area? Sweet potatoes grown in your area? I mean, did there used to be an industry growing this or that or the other thing? Okay, that probably works. What did the natives used to grow there? Did they grow corn? Did they grow pumpkins? What type of beans did they grow? What might work there? And then go talk to your neighbors, just like you said. Go. I said, look at that old guy or that old lady down the street that has that little garden in their backyard. You really need to make friends with them. And there's a snootiness too. When we talk about gardening cults. Well, I saw on YouTube. So we go down there and we see the guy. You know, you see somebody putting in their rows and they're planting. Oh, you plant hybrids? Well, you know, old people. Yeah. Old people, God. Okay, so I've seen people that are like, I have a permaculture garden. And you see that they've done everything that they saw, right? They've got the deep mulch. They've got heirloom varieties. And they've got, like, okra with yellow leaves. And like a handful of food over here and some weeds that they eat because that's a really good weed. They saw it in a foraging video. Okay, that's great. But that guy down the street is canning 40 quarts of beans every fall. And the amount of food coming out of your perfect ideal system is terrible. So your primary has got to be food. How do you grow food? Obtain a yield. Because we're talking about survival, right? We're not talking about trying to leave the soil in the absolute most pristine condition ever. We're not talking about like how many bacteria or fungi we may kill or whatever else. That your primary, I know we always get in trouble for this, like how we're yanking profits out of the ground and destroying the ecosystem. You don't want to do that. But when you get to a point where you're hungry, you need to know how to extract food from dirt. And by golly, you're just going to grab whatever you have available. If you don't, you know, if you don't have a gun to go hunting, you're going to make a spear, right? You're just going to do whatever you can do. Yeah. And you want to move towards the ideal. But if your neighbor down the road is bringing in a lot of food, find out how they do it. And then then you start to say, okay, what is the most sustainable way I could do this? If he's throwing around 10, 10, 10, obviously we know that those salts are burning the ground out over time. If he's not putting humus back in it, well, that's going to be a problem. Maybe his gardens are deteriorating over time. Maybe he says, you know, 5 years ago we used to have a ton of tomatoes, but it hasn't been so good lately because there's more bugs. And you're like, wait a minute. Now I know that soil fertility is linked to diseases and to infestations because those things come as cleanup crews when we have a sick population. So maybe if we did that, okay, so you might share some of that knowledge with him, but what I would really do is go home and figure out how to grow food first before you go back and try to lecture him on not deep mulching or on his tilling or his use of fertilizers. You have to get the information first and know, okay, he's using this set of tools. That's not the set of tools I wish we could use, but I need to learn how to actually grow food before I, you know, get into a philosophical debate. A lot of people get into philosophical debates who haven't actually done anything. There's a story in the book of Acts where Paul is spreading the gospel. He's telling the story of Jesus Christ all over the world, and he goes to Athens, and Athens at that point is a city. It's like almost 500 years removed from their height. Back when, you know, it was Aristotle and Plato and everything, they're way removed from their height. And so these guys get together and they hang out in the square. He's like starts preaching on the street and they're like, oh, this is interesting. Why don't you come out to the public forum and we'll have a debate and we'll talk about it. And so there's the Stoics and the Epicureans and the people who are Platonists and whatever. And Paul gets out there and he starts sharing with them. And he's like, you have this statue over here to an unknown God. I'm going to tell you about this unknown God. He did this, he did this, he did this. And he kind of like approaches them philosophically with looking around at what they have. He quotes their own poets and he has this discussion. And then they turn around and they're like, oh, this man is very interesting. Let's have another discussion tomorrow. Will you come back tomorrow? We'll hear you again on this. What fun. It's all philosophy. They're not doing anything. It's like a bunch of guys in togas wandering around going, oh, how, thank you for entertaining us with your story of a foreign god. Oh, well, that's great. We can do this again tomorrow. Why don't we have one of the Epicureans talk to you about it? And Paul goes home and he's like, I'm done. I'm done. These guys aren't doing anything. They're just wandering around the ruins of a great civilization having discussions. You know, you got to get out there and you got to get your hands in the dirt. And definitely go talk to your neighbors first because they actually have dirty hands. You know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's a lot of that sort of trapped in the left brain going on right now, I think, too. When I watch your videos, I often see cats running around, but you've also mentioned how important it is to integrate animals like chickens. So
right.
Speak to that a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like the cats. My kids. Okay. So we live on this street in the middle of nowhere. So people drop animals on our road. One time the kids saved 9 puppies off the side of the road. And I'm like,
goodness.
They're like, can we keep them? No, you definitely can't keep them. We don't even have a fence and we're renting 9 puppies. So anyhow, we had to find like homes for the puppies. But then this cat showed up and I'm like, I'm always telling people like, I don't want cats in the garden. I'm going to get toxoplasmosis. I'll like get crazy, right? It'll make you crazy, man. Cats will get in your head. Next thing you know, you're just like looking at cat memes all day and then posting pictures of cats. And you don't want to do that. But anyhow, the cats do have a bit of use in that they'll, you know, they're allegedly they will hunt vermin like but rats and mice, but these cats really don't really do that. They seem to just like wander around behind me in the garden every time I turn the camera on, so it looks like I'm a crazy cat lady. But anyhow, so my kids adopted them, and I don't know, I'm just soft or something. The animal integration though, cats and dogs are usually not particularly useful in the garden. As much as people love them as pets, dogs can be useful for chasing off deer. You know, cats can be useful for killing rats and mice, but realistically, you get way more benefit from something like chickens or ducks or goats or cows, the animals that are traditionally part of agriculture, which they produce a yield themselves at the same time increasing the yields of your gardens. So it's not like a zero-sum sort of a system where you're going to get some yield over here or some yield over here. It's almost like there's a synergy that happens when you mix animals and plants together. So all the people that are like, the future is plant-based, you know, don't, you know, I can't believe you keep animals. So like somebody told me, oh my gosh, you have all these chickens in a cage. The future is cage-free. And I'm like, you know what would happen if I took this cage off these chickens? They would be dead. in like a day, because everything in the world wants to eat chicken. And besides, I told them, you know, I said they're in a small space because they're tiny house chickens and they're reducing their carbon footprint. So don't judge. No, a friend of mine told me that. I was like, oh my gosh, dude, I can't, you know.
That's well played.
If you mix together the animals with the plants, you get another dynamic layer. But it is really difficult for backyard gardeners to do this reasonably. A lot of times on a backyard scale, say, you know, your chicken flock or whatever, they might say you can have 6 birds and you can't have a rooster, which means you have a non-procreative flock. So you still have to bring in from outdoor. You're still the city importing from the country. You have to get, you know, more chickens from a hatchery or whatever, your feed store, which got it from a hatchery. You know, you can't reproduce. That's a problem. And also the layer of complexity that comes in when you integrate animals into the system is a real thing. We got a pair of sheep, and within 1 month, one of the sheep died. We got 2 sheep. We didn't know anything about sheep. The sheep had worms, and so we treated them for worms, and we like called somebody, and they're like, well, that has pneumonia. You have to give that sheep penicillin. It's like, oh my gosh, I have to inject the sheep with penicillin. That's weird. So we inject the sheep with penicillin, and I'm like, you know, somewhere out here, Jeff Lawton going, you know, you're messing up. Like, but I'm like, I got to keep this sheep alive, right? And it's like, we try all this. We give a course of penicillin. We're giving them like the minerals and everything that we can think of, like new pasture every day. And they're getting moved around, and we're like trying to give them everything we can, and the sheep dies. And then I call this person with sheep, and they're like, well, sheep just die. It's like pretty common that sheep die. And like, I've been raising sheep for years, and they just die sometimes. You got sheep that already had a worm load from that farm. It's not your fault. And I'm like, I mean, you feel you it's kind of sad when like one of your lettuces died, but you only think about it for about a half a second. It's like, oh, a lettuce died. But when a sheep died, it feels like it's a little closer to you, and you're like, yeah. Oh, that kind of hurts. Like, I really feel bad that the sheep feels bad, and I can't make her happy. And I'm like petting her. I'm like, come on, sweetie, come on, you can get better, you know. And I'm not like that with the turnips. I'm just like, yeah, turnips didn't do it. But with like animals, you're like, oh gosh, you really want to take care of them because they're a little closer to you. They kind of have thought processes. They feel pain. They feel cold. They're, you know, you're like, you want to be really compassionate and work it out.
For sure.
But they're also working animals. You can't, a lot of times people treat them like they're total pets. You know, I have a friend that's had goats for like 10 years because he had this idea they would have their own dairy, but instead his kids just turned the goats into pets, and they never slaughtered the wethers, and they ended up with like, they started with 4 and they ended up with like 19 goats. And there's just this huge area of pasture that's torn down by goats, and they don't get any milk or anything. The goats are just like yard ornaments hopping around the yard. And that's not useful. I mean, I suppose you could eat them all eventually if you wanted to, but it becomes a very expensive thing. You pour more into the animals. So the ideal system is that you're raising enough fodder. And I think you probably need to have at least a half an acre or so, you know, you're raising enough fodder for the animals to eat. And that would be like in the tropics, because if you're outside of the tropics, the further north you get, the harder it is to get fodder year round. You're going to buy stuff, and then you're back to importing from somewhere else. Yep. So you got to have enough for the fodder, and then you got to rotate the animals through it to keep the animals healthy. They've got to be moving around on different ground. You have to have enough soil minerals in the ground to make sure that when they're grazing, they're just living off of what is in that dirt. It's not like you, where your corn came from Iowa and your steak came from Michigan and this came from Alabama and this came from Florida and you got orange juice from here and you've got bananas from South America and you're probably getting minerals off of a whole bunch of different soils. They have to rely completely on just the soil that you've given them and whatever you happen to put out for them. So it's difficult. So if I was going to be a small gardener, I would say that the one that makes the most sense is chickens, but I've even written on the economics of chickens, and people are spending like $10, you know, for a dozen eggs from their chickens at home because, well, you've got to have cages so the predators don't get it, and you've got to make sure you're buying feed, and then you want to buy good feed that's not GMO feed, then you're going to be spending more, and you've got to go out, and your time costs something, and it's got to be working through. But then again, when you put those chickens in the garden and you like make an area that you run the chickens through on grass in particular, you can grow the most amazing pasture grass and the most amazing humus by rotating through animals, an intense amount of animals on the ground in a short period of time, and then move them on, and then move them on, and then move them on. And this is a huge stimulating effect that takes place because animals and plants are supposed to be together. It's this big designed system where everything interlocks, and every piece that you take out is another piece that you have to fill in somewhere else. So if you don't have the animals, what do you got to do? Well, you got to scratch the ground up and take the weeds out and feed it with some manure from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So integrating animals into it is valuable, and chickens probably make the most sense. Rabbits almost make sense to just feed weeds and alfalfa pellets and stuff too, just to use the manure.
Yep.
But a rabbit meat operation, again, is going to take you time and effort, and it works in some climates and it works for some people, but not for others. Some people just don't want to deal with slaughtering, and some people don't want to deal with animal care every day. And you're also tied to your land, and animals tie you down, whereas plants don't tie you down that much. When you finish with your round of sweet corn, you can pretty much ignore your fruit trees for a month and go visit friends and family and do whatever you want. You can't do that with animals. But animals are definitely a big part of the integration of systems. I say ideally we would have animals in our backyard. We would live on a chunk of a couple of acres at least, and we would probably recycle all of our human wastes back into the system as well. We would have composting toilet systems, so you eat everything, whatever your body doesn't use gets recycled back into the land, and you're actually building this loop of fertility where it's getting richer and richer and richer and richer, instead of doing what we do now and extract, buy a bag of fertilizer, extract, buy a bag of fertilizer, extract, you know. But again, it's into ideal systems. Ideally, everybody would live in the country and could work on these things and build what really makes sense, you know, and run your cows through the orchard and that sort of thing. But it's something to think on.
Yeah, really good points there. I think they definitely are more time and capital and effort expensive. And so there's a learning curve, obviously, for the animals themselves. I almost feel like, given how many people are urban or just need to be taking some of those constraints into consideration, that even quail and, like you said, rabbits could be good places to start if you're really just looking for the fertility to help close the loop. But again, reemphasizing what you said, that humanure or the composting toilets can achieve that as well, can make sure you close the loop on your nutrients there. Yeah, so those are interesting points. What else with the supply chain in disarray? How else is that informing the way you think about structuring a garden?
I've been thinking for the last couple of years on writing a book called Minimalist Gardening. So, how would you garden if you had almost nothing? And so the supply line things, we were living on the island of Grenada at the bottom of the Caribbean when the pandemic hit. And I was reading the stuff coming out in February. I was reading stories of this virus that is coming through China. I'm like, I wonder if that came over. I wonder if it's as bad as they say it is. And then it spreads over to Italy and it's like, oh, it's got a 10% kill rate. Like 1 out of 10 people. I'm like, somebody in my family is going to die if we get this virus. That's pretty scary, man. Maybe 2 of us. Wow, I've got one son that's got some asthma. So he might die first. We got to figure out, like, if this thing is really this bad, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to plant more. So I had all this plant. I had already had my gardens going. And so I just expanded and I planted. I had dug this area for a driveway that was going to be cast with concrete. I tore the driveway back up and I planted beds in it. And I put beds over here and there, and it was easy to expand because in the tropics, there's no time of year, really. It's dry season and wet season. The dry season, I carry water. The wet season, I don't. And so I'm like, okay, corn. We definitely need corn. We need pigeon peas, so we have storable protein. We need to plant more yam roots. We need to plant more cassava. Cassava's got to go everywhere we can. We need bananas and plantains for carbohydrates. And so I just, we just filled the whole yard up. And then by the time they locked all the grocery stores and everything down a couple of months later, I was already getting yields. And I was like, eh, we're good. I mean, I stockpiled some rum and good, you know? I even grew tobacco. I'm like, dang, man. Like, grow tobacco, it's the end of the world. I'm not going to go buy cigars. I'm going to just sit out and, like, smoke my own tobacco. So I'm living in, like, we've got an outdoor shower. I've got composting toilets. I've got a big compost bin that's got tons of composted, like, humanure and shredded leaves and stuff all covering it. And we've got a river down at the bottom, so I could go and haul buckets of water up to start to give to the seedlings just in case. Like, sometimes we would haul river water because, like, okay, let's pretend that the water system breaks and we don't have the water coming from the parish coming through anymore. And so we had all this, you know, all this stuff in place, and we had plenty of food. And the supply lines were busted. One thing that we didn't have enough of was meat, but this enterprising guy started breaking the rules and driving around during the pandemic with like two big coolers on the back of his truck. He's like, yeah, man, you're buying some meat. I got some muffin. I got mutton and beef. I can get some fishes tomorrow. And I'm like, okay, cool. So it's like he opens it up and there's just like piles of meat. And I'm like, good. Now we got meat too, man. That's awesome. So we were ahead of the game, like, by far, because I have a really healthy level of paranoia. So, which I'm sure you understand.
Well, it's not paranoia if they're actually after you, right?
It's not paranoia if they're actually after you. No, we really knew, like, something bad was coming. We didn't know how, like, what the government reaction and stuff was going to be. But anyhow, my wife is like, I cannot believe how well we did through that. When everybody was freaking out because they locked down all the grocery stores, too. And then they would only let you in for, like, 4 hours by last name. And then stuff was just disappearing where you couldn't even get things. And, I mean, it was like the end of the world. And we were in a foreign country, and I didn't even have internet. I had to go up to I would hike to the top of a mountain about 2 miles away, and then I could see a cell tower, and I could get cellular internet. And then I'd write my family, we're still okay. You know, and I even did live streams from the top of the mountain. I had my son build a desk out of scrap wood, and I hauled it to the top of the mountain, and a chair. And I took a chair and a desk, and I put it on the top of this mountain ridge on the edge of this guy's farm. And I hid it in the bushes when I wasn't there, but I had stuff, like, hidden up there. And, like, this is my office. I can't go to town and get internet because the resorts are all closed where I was borrowing internet. It used to be, like, a bunch of, like, pretty girls walking down the beach and, like, old boomers, like, and like, it's, like, this real chill resort. And I would just go out there with my Mac laptop and talk about survival gardening. And then next thing you know, all that's gone, and I'm really actually survival gardening.
Yeah, yeah.
And it worked, which is always, it's like, this is awesome. Thank you, God, for sending me an almost collapse of civilization so I can know that what I was doing is actually resilient and actually works. That holding all those different plant materials, that having planted all those things, that testing all those varieties was really valid and worked. The supply line issue, practically speaking, if you need to garden with almost nothing, the first thing you should do is get a few hand tools. You know, like, if you can get an antique hoe head from before they welded them, you go on eBay and the whole head is one piece of steel it's got the swan's neck, and it's one solid piece, an old hoe head. Those things last forever. They don't break on the weld. If you can get a hoe, the big hoe head, like an iHoe, grub hoe, that you can put a handle on, that's awesome. EasyDigging.com sells some of these old-fashioned tools. I love that guy, Greg Baca. He's brilliant. If you ever want another guest, I would totally call him. He's brilliant, and he's been designing all of these handheld tools for years. He loves, like, working with your hands. What is the absolute fail-safe tool? You know, and so a spading fork would be good if you can get a good one. And a machete. You can use a machete for transplanting, for chopping, for harvesting, for cutting things open. There's a ton of uses for a good machete. And you're going to feed your garden. You've got to feed your garden with something. You can go out to the woods and you can take a piece of screening like hardware cloth and tack it to a little frame of 2x4s. Go out into the woods and sift humus out of the woods if you need to loot humus from somewhere. Go and dig up, you know, take the top layer and just scrape some stuff up and sift it. You don't need a ton in your garden. I mean, you have this idea like you've got to have a huge amount of compost in your garden. You only need like that much on the surface for each season. It's like a half an inch or quarter inch, depending on your soil. It's not a ton, but that's enough for your plants to have to get the exchange that they need and to have a little bit of life in there, and you're also adding in those bacteria and fungi. Ashes, you need ashes for your potassium, for calcium, and balancing pH. So just make a wood fire. You know, when you're out there roasting the pig that you killed with a spear, you know, save some of the ashes underneath. Save the guts of the pig. Dig trenches in your gardens in between areas that you're not currently necessarily gardening in or you're going to be gardening in. Dig trenches and just bury feathers and guts, human waste. It doesn't matter. Like dead fish, anything that's like really high in fertility. If it's got meat in it, if it's got blood in it, right, bones, all that stuff, it's all really useful. And just completely ignore all this common, this namby-pamby, like, oh, you don't compost meat. You know, forget that stuff. That's nonsense. That's where there's a huge amount of fertility in a dead animal, right? But just bury it deep enough so predators don't dig it up and tear your garden to pieces, and your plant roots will find it eventually. When that sheep died, I didn't throw the sheep in the trash can. You know, the sheep went in the garden.
Right.
I will be gardening on that sheep. There's probably enough fertility in that sheep to feed those trees for the next 5 years that I buried it next to. So you're going to use everything that you can. If you're close to a source of seaweed, you get all those micronutrients from the seaweed. If you cut the grass, get a scythe or a sickle, cut the grass down to make compost wood. Let the grass grow really tall and then chop it up. Compost. You know, you can glean stuff from all over the place to feed the garden. If you need to, you can dilute your own urine, like 6 part water to 1 part urine. It's kind of disgusting, but there's your nitrogen. That freaks people out. But it's been done. You can survive. You know, you can keep the food growing. And what you basically want to do is reduce everything to the bare needs. The supply lines break. You should also have a supply of seed, and you should also be saving some seed from varieties that you have adapted to your climate. This year, I am mixing a whole bunch of different varieties of pumpkins into the Seminole pumpkin line I already had growing and throwing them all at the ground under both good conditions and in horrible conditions. I'm going to have some untaken care of, some land that has no care whatsoever. I'm just going to till it and plant seeds into it. And if any of those survive, I know that they have some genetics for bad times. So I'll save some seeds from those. But I'm also going to make sure that I get a yield. I dig pits and I throw slaughter wastes and kitchen scraps and like old lasagna or whatever else in the bottom of the pit, and I plant pumpkins on top of them. The pumpkin roots go down about 2 feet, touch that stuff, the vines get really green, they'll fill an entire area. You can have horrible soil, grow a bunch of stuff, but you got to start looking at everything as potential soil fertility and not, you know, throwing your limbs by the side of the road and throwing your kitchen scraps in the trash. That's insane. Don't do that anymore.
Right. You know? Which is what motivated your book title, Compost Everything, which I love.
Right.
One last question. Another of your books was Pushing the Zone. And I feel like it's about, you know, growing things maybe in a little bit colder climates or finding ways to – I feel like there's a little bit of ice age farming going on there. So you want to tell a little bit about how – tell me your thoughts on that.
It's one of my favorite topics is plant genetics and like how plants adapt and can live in different areas. Like, how can you play with the boundaries of what's possible? And Push the Zone was the culmination of a bunch of experiments I did in North Florida, which is I was about 2 zones north of the tropics. We had our lowest temperature that I recorded during the time that I was there was 12 degrees. We didn't get long frost events. There were fast dips, and it would come back up. So the next day it was back up to 35 by, you know, 11 o'clock. But it hit 12 degrees sometime early in the morning. It's nasty. That will kill any tropical crop. And unfortunately for gardeners, I mean, tropical crops... for us temperate gardeners, tropical crops are the most productive crops in the entire world. You can grow roots that are this big in one season, like 10,000 calories, just by hacking a hunk off of one of those Dioscorea species yams, throwing it into the ground and covering it and ignoring it for a year. And then you go back and you dig up something this big. The climate is perfect for bacteria and fungi to break down compost. Your compost pile is flawless and effortless all year round. The sheer variety of plant species is so insane. There's so many edible things. You can't even imagine we're talking tons of fruit, falling on the ground from untended mango trees. Nobody can eat it. There's no way you can even eat the productivity of the tropics. It makes you really sad.
Yeah.
I mean, people like up north, right? I mean, Julie from Dirt Patch Heaven, she's got a YouTube channel. She's in Idaho. And she's like, I can't believe your growing season down there. I'm so jealous. And I'm like, I can't believe the growing season I used to have in the tropics. This is just zone 8. Dude, I was like, it was incredible. I could just spit seeds on the ground and like papaya trees would grow. And you just ignore the papaya trees, and next thing you've got 100 pounds of fruit. It's insane, right? So I always wanted to play with stuff from the tropics. So when I was in North Florida, I was like, what if I could grow coffee here? What if I could grow key limes here, and they wouldn't freeze to the ground? What if I could grow papaya here? So I experimented with microclimates and zone pushing, trying to find the areas where you could pull stuff up a zone or even two zones. So I had tests. I ended up killing a lot of plants. I planted mango seedlings all over my yard, and all of them died. And occasionally, they would come back. I have a jackfruit in my front yard there that froze down and would come back and freeze down. And I was actually surprised that it would even do that, because it's not, I mean, it's really a totally tropical tree. I managed to keep coffee alive on the back of my house in zone 8 through nights that went down into the 20s and maybe even into the teens one night. Coffee didn't die. Because there was a microclimate of the back of the house, I realized that the back foot and a half behind the side of the house was the climate of Miami. So even on a freezing night, there was that one little strip. I said, this is my Miami garden. The entire back of the house, we cleared out every bit of junk I could to get sunshine in there. And I gardened this strip. Black pepper, guavas, coffee, key lime. Right? I'm like eating key lime pie. And I mean, I had a group of master gardeners by. And I had this great big couple of papaya. And the papaya were just all over the tree. And this master gardener is going through my yard on a tour, and this one goes, huh, papaya, it's too bad those don't grow here. She walks past it, and I'm like.
Yeah. Yeah, people, I think you're right. People, they really, that's hilarious. People get really locked into the, you know, I am zone 9, and just like defining themselves as that. And they sort of, they stop the thinking process. And that's why this experimental, the playful attitude is really important. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, what I believe the climate, people are always like, what do you think, you know, you think the, you know, it's too bad you live in, when I lived in Florida, it's too bad you live in Florida, you're going to be underwater in 20 years. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I don't think that the predictive models have been particularly impressive on anything. Most people couldn't see the housing crisis coming in 2007 and then the crash in 2008. I saw that coming a mile away because I was reading economists that had been dead for 80 years or longer. Oh, yeah, dude, it's going to crash. It's totally going to crash. So when people say, oh, it's definitely, you know, like all the ice caps are going to melt and we're not going to have any glaciers left and stuff, I take that really completely not seriously at all, because you can't predict the weather a few months down. We don't know, because it's a very dynamic system. And I have studied the other side of, you know, ice age cycles, sun cycles, you know, volcanic activity, et cetera, you know, the year without a summer. These things happen really, really fast and blow the entire system out where you don't expect it.
Yeah.
Really weird stuff happens. Some of it may be man-made. Some of it is nature-made. But nature is a really huge, dynamic, complicated system that really doesn't care what you think. And the only thing you can do, I mean, other than pray to God that everything works out okay, which is obviously a good idea, is to plan for some sort of resiliency. And Nassim Taleb wrote a book called Anti-Fragile, Things That Benefit from Disorder. And so my gardening systems often benefit from disorder because I deliberately plant stuff that doesn't fit the climate. I plant stuff from below the chill hours, right? Okay, my area is such and such chill hour. I get 450 chill hours, which means I'm just going to plant this narrow band of selections that the University Extension Office says I should plant that fit it. But then you get a really warm winter. and all of those go don't bloom, or they bloom too early and they freeze off. Or so what I do is I plant stuff from two zones south, two zones north, and in my zone. And I plant lots of things from seeds. So if we have genetic variation that maybe will adapt to the climate, we've got that too. So you plant a whole bunch of different stuff. You get a really warm winter, your stuff that's more tropical loves that. You get a really cold winter, your more temperate stuff loves that. We don't know how the climate is going to shift in 5 years, 10 years, 1 year. We don't know what it's going to be like tomorrow sometimes. And so what you're doing is you're creating systems. Forests tend to survive, and the species will change over time according to how the climate is settling. So what I want to do is put the large amount of genetic diversity and species together and then see which ones get killed and which ones live, and continuously be planting seedlings from the ones that live and plant new varieties all the time, putting in all kinds of different things. So you have this huge amount of redundancy. Like if you work for one guy and you have a bad day and you accidentally throw a computer out of the window, just you get fired, right? Then you're in trouble, right? But if you worked for one guy, but you also had a side job, you know, you're a Uber driver for the stars. You've got a little YouTube channel where you explain how refrigerators work, and then you've got, you know, you've written a little book on your like martial arts skills. And right, so you got a bunch of different irons in the fire. You're a little less fragile. But seriously speaking, like if you know how to do plumbing, you can fall back on plumbing, though you may be currently working in forestry. And if you are maintaining it, like I've worked for myself since 2005, and I tried to have when I started working on my own radio business and doing, I used to write radio copy and do production and stuff. I would try to have at least three clients. And if I went down to two clients, I would actively start pursuing, spending a day a week, trying to find somebody else that was a third client, because three legs is a balanced stool. Two is not quite so stable. One, all your eggs in one basket. It may be really well paying at the moment, but it may be gone tomorrow. So if you're like, I am just going to plant this one variety of chestnut over my entire yard because it's the best variety, that's a bad idea. That's not anti-fragile. Yep. It may work, and it may work until you die. But then one day it may just not work. Yeah. And if all of your eggs are in one basket, if you think, I'm absolutely sure that this is the best thing that I could ever do, and you stop learning, the system will something is going to break at some point. It's actually way less anti-fragile to go and get your degree and study and get a whole ton of debt and then go into this one career that's definitely the high-paying career that you really, really want, and then you buy the house on a mortgage, and then you get married and you have your 2.1 children, but your whole career is like working for one big company. What happens when the company, when a pandemic comes, tons and tons of people have like been totally blown out of their jobs because of various reasons. And things have totally changed overnight. They're not anti-fragile. The debt suddenly is like right behind you, about to eat you, and it's looming over you. And your career maybe doesn't look so good anymore. And everybody's applying for a job at the same time. When the Great Depression hit, nobody knew that there, you know, these successful people were going to be standing in bread lines a year later because like their whole stock portfolio was gone. It was a sure bet. I mean, everybody's getting rich in the stock market.
That's right.
If all your eggs are in one basket, you're going to blow. And the same thing on the climate. Just plant as many things as you can. Know how to grow a whole bunch of stuff. Don't just plant a big field of potatoes. You know, and learn how to push the zone one way and the other. And some stuff is going to die, but you don't care because you're not going to die. You've got a bunch of other stuff. One thing dies, who cares?
Yep. The diversity is there to help you diversify. I've heard that from garden scale all the way up to, you know, when I spoke to Gabe Brown about his ranch operation, he's saying the same thing. He throws out a cover crop mix with 9 or 11 different
right.
things in it because
right.
something – something is going to grow. And so it was the typical prepper credo of one is none, two is better, three is for me, works here as well. So we threw out a bunch of techniques before, and people can go check them out. One that you've invented and so are the expert on would be the grocery row garden. So can you sort of run us through what or how you design that and what it means?
Yes. for years I liked anarchistic systems. My wife likes organized systems. So when we were younger, she wanted to get into gardening, but she looked at my gardens where I would throw a whole bunch of different things out and then cut pathways through it and then hack things down and move things around. All of my playing around with, you know, like permaculture, polycultures, and all this stuff. She looks at that and she says, I don't even know what to pick for dinner. I don't even know what all that mess is. I can't tell this brassica from that brassica. And she goes, what about that square foot garden stuff? And I'm like, well, I'll buy you square foot gardening. We'll make a couple of beds. I mean, I read gardening books. I guess I really should probably try. At that point, I was only writing articles. I hadn't actually started writing books yet because I didn't feel like I had enough knowledge and experience where I wanted to write books yet. So I was writing articles on what I was testing and trying and stuff. So I said, yeah, you know what? I could probably write some articles on square foot gardening. So I read the book and she read the book and I built her like the little perfect square foot garden. And what I've realized is that most people want to be told what to do. Whereas generally I don't like to be told what to do. I want you to share what you're doing and then I want to try it. But I don't want to slavishly adhere to a system. I want to try every different system and see which piece I like and which piece I don't like and experiment. My wife is not an experimenter. She wants to follow the recipe. She's like, give me the recipe and I could follow it. So she read Square Foot Gardening and she got a couple of square foot garden beds. She's really great with it. She pulled out like great big cabbages and cauliflower and stuff. And I was like, oh, that's working really well. Actually, it was working better than a lot of my experiments at that point. Because it's a system that somebody tested and it works and it works. It just works. So, you know, I played around with anarchistic systems and I built a couple of food forests in Florida. I did one in tropical South Florida and I did one 5 hours north in semi-temperate North Florida where it freezes and it kills the tropical stuff. And between those two systems, I planted tons of different trees and I figured out which ones worked and which ones didn't. And I did a lot of chop and drop. I made a lot I built soil in beautiful ways where it went from just terrible sand to rich soil. And fungi started showing up and everything was amazing and gorgeous, but that's like a long-term system. So in the backyard at the same time, I did some beds where I put borders on them. Somebody had done some raised beds and then their house was being foreclosed on. So they gave me all the frames for the beds. And I was like, oh, I'll do some raised beds. So I did some raised beds over here. And I did a couple of square foot gardens for my wife. And then I did those mounded beds where I cut into the ground. And then I tried just tilling an area and planting corn alongside the driveway without feeding it at all, just to see what would happen. And then I borrowed a guy's field, which had no irrigation. And then I tested over there. And meanwhile, I'm reading and playing around and watching people do all these different types of systems. And I realized, like, there's a balance between order and disorder is better than necessarily being completely neurotic and building the perfectly orderly system. So if you build a perfectly orderly system, you have the issues of a monoculture. You have the issues of the soil degrading over time because you're simply extracting without adding into it. If you don't have other things integrated into it, you have pest issues because you don't have that, you know, carrots love tomatoes and whatever, you know, you mix all those things up and then the pests don't exactly know what to do with it. You don't have a bunch of different foods coming in. And I realize I love trees, but trees take a few years to get going. And so if you plant a straight up food forest, you're looking at 3 years, 4 years before you even really start getting much in the way of fruit or anything. You've taken up a ton of space and you're not really getting much yield out of it. Now you can fill in some gaps with, you know, tilling some little areas and putting in sweet potatoes and pumpkins and things like that. But eventually the canopy closes. And then I was reading on pruning and some like extreme pruning. How do the bonsai guys make a mango fruit at a foot tall? You've got a tree that's this big with a mango this big off of one side. How do they do that? How do people keep trees inside of picking height? How do you turn, pear trees into a hedge? They're like, I'm looking at all these different things. And then I watched, Stefan Sapkowiak's The Permaculture Orchard video that, Paul Wheaton produced. And I love the way he had an orchard But in the orchard, he alternated all of his trees. Instead of it just being an apple orchard, he took an old apple orchard and he turned it into something different. It's like a cherry tree here and a plum tree here and then a pear tree here and then an apple tree here and then this. And then on the ground in between, he put different plants and berries and currants and all this kind of stuff. Oh, that's really cool. And there's this guy called Andrew Millison, who I think he's with Oregon State. And he's got this great video on his edible hedge. And I love the idea of edible hedges, where like the whole front of your yard, you've mixed a whole bunch of species, so you have this polyculture hedge. It's like 4 foot wide hedge, but you're picking stuff through it all the time. And so I swung really far over into all perennials. I want to do all perennials because that's the most ideal thing. They become self-perpetuating. The ground gets mulched and you really don't have to care for them over time. But what I was realizing with my food forest was I was still getting way more yields out of my annual gardens. And we're talking like 90 days, I've got buckets of food. Mm-hmm. 90 days compared to 9 years, maybe, yeah, for buckets of food off of a particular tree. Chestnuts. I did the comparison on chestnuts. People will tell you, you know, chestnuts are actually, let's see, tree crops, J. Russell Smith. J. Russell Smith writes about chestnuts being a good alternative to growing wheat. So instead of having to till the soil and plant wheat and grow wheat and harvest wheat and thresh your wheat, there are these plantations of chestnuts. And chestnuts have a similar nutrient profile. So you could dry them and make flour out of them. You could eat them fresh. You could get through. You won't starve if you have a chestnut tree.
Interesting.
So I called a chestnut orchard that was growing chestnuts, and I asked them what their yields were per chestnut tree. And it was about 25 pounds of chestnuts after it was 10 years. And at 20 years, you're probably going to hit about 50 pounds per tree. And I thought, wow. Well, you don't really have to work for it. But 50 pounds? If I plant one pumpkin vine, I can get a comparable amount of carbohydrates and the same amount of production in 100 days, 110 days. I think that I'm too obsessed with the perfect idea of a perennial polyculture, right? You have the idea that everybody has it wrong, and I am going to be the one, and there's like a few luminaries that I follow, and all of us together are going to get, it's going to be amazing. You know, I got this idea, like, we can beat 6,000 years of agriculture this generation. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to plant a perennial polyculture that really, really works. We're not going to live on annuals. But what I was realizing, I kept planting more and more perennials because I love all these trees. I love the huge variety, and I like going out and picking handfuls of small fruits and like seeing the first nut grow on the chestnut, etc. But really, I was feeding my family mostly from the annual beds while I was building my ideal perfect system. And everybody wanted to hear about the food forest, but nobody really cared about the row gardens of potatoes. Mm-hmm. The boring thing in the back was really the amazing thing. So I had this love for tree and perennials, and I have this, there is a resiliency to trees that annuals don't have. If anything gets screwed up during a season with annuals, like they don't get watered for 2 or 3 weeks, you don't get rain or whatever, it's a bad deal. It's done. You just missed your opportunity. You may get another chance in fall if you're lucky, but you may not because the bugs might eat it. But with trees, they just keep growing and growing and growing and growing and growing, and you often get these massive harvests, even in a year where you might have had a month of drought. The tree has got deep roots. It doesn't care. You know. So how do you have the resiliency of perennials and the wide variety of perennials and the permanency of perennials where you don't constantly have to work at them with the production of annuals? And a lot of the food forest systems, you'll see it over and over again. Bill Mollison in particular talked about it, the value of edge. You know, the edge of the system between where the prairie grasses and the annual weeds and stuff hit the edge of the woods, there's this area of microclimate where you've got this mass of vines and flowers and blackberries and all this stuff that happens right there where there's a little bit of shade and protection and humus from the the woods, and then there's the sunshine and the open air of the annual and the prairie grasses and stuff. So there's like that edge of the system is where the amazing stuff happens. It's the shoreline of the beach, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was looking at, I was like, you know, Stefan Subkowiak with the permaculture orchard really has a cool thing going. And so I did a live stream after looking at that, and after looking at a lot and planning out, I was planting some hedges on my property down in the Caribbean and making edible hedgerow system down the side of the yard. And I thought, you know, if I just did hedge after hedge after hedge, I could have infinite edge almost. It's like edge through the whole yard. And I had just read Anne Ralph's book, Grow a Little Fruit Tree, where she talks about extreme pruning and how you can keep fruit trees like right at head height. So even if you had a tiny backyard or a patio garden, you could grow a full-size tree that has been pruned down, full-size rootstock, all the bigger of a full-size, but it's been pruned down. People don't realize like how much you can cut a tree for production. So I had all this stuff rattling around in my head, and I did this live stream, and I said, I think the ideal garden would be an overlapping of the perennials and the annuals in a row garden system. So it's like edge. Sort of like the permaculture orchard, but more like a row of edible hedges or something. And somebody says, oh, you have to see syntropic agriculture. I'm like, I haven't heard of syntropic agriculture. What's this? So I look it up and I find out this guy sends me all this information on it. And I find out the reason I hadn't really heard about it is most of the information is like in Portuguese, and it's going on in Brazil. And I'm like, oh, this guy is awesome. Right. So Ernst Gotsch, he's got these, he's using bananas, and he's chopping the bananas, and he's creating all of this humus with bananas. And he has this really complicated like rotation system, but they're basically annual perennial beds that are, it's agroforestry in rows. And he does tons of pruning with a chainsaw. He's just constantly chainsawing stuff down and letting it fall and building up the soil that would generally be horrible soil. He's keeping a humus layer on top of it and building in these row beds. And I said, that's about what I was talking about, but it's still a little complicated. And it's still targeted towards the tropics. I was thinking, like, how would you do that on something like that on a backyard scale? So I took all the information that I had been gathering for years and all of the fight in my head between annuals and perennials, and I said, 4-foot wide beds. I like 4-foot wide beds. 4-foot wide beds with 3-foot wide paths, which seems like a waste of space until you start trying to haul materials around. And when you're hauling materials around and when you have children helping you and stuff, like walking little tiny pathways is psychologically uncomfortable and you don't want to step on the beds. Plus, that 3-foot bed is a 3-foot pathway also allows water to percolate in and get caught, and it creates more edge. You need that sunshine space. Mm-hmm. Maximum planting does not mean maximum productivity. Like, you could get more productivity off of one apple tree with tons of space than you could 20 of them planted together, because they're going to fight. So you're going to breathe a little bit. And so I said, okay, now let's overlay an orchard on it. So I sketched out an orchard over 4-foot wide beds with 3-foot wide paths. What do you need for orchard spacing? Provided you're going to prune the trees so they get no taller than 8 feet. I want to be able to reach. I want my kids to be able to pretty much pick the trees without having to get up on a ladder. And I want to be able to keep cutting those prunings and throwing them on the ground. And I want to plant full-size trees and full-size vigorous rootstocks that are then kept under control. So you have that vigor of a full-size rootstock. Those dwarfing rootstocks are basically just strangling the top of the tree.
Yeah.
You know, you get fast production because the tree's like, oh my gosh, I have to have a baby before I die. And they start pushing out fruit really fast. But we're talking, it's probably going to be a 10-year tree unless you really take care of it. Whereas old trees, man, like 100-year-old apple trees, those were probably seedlings or grafted onto seedlings, and that was back when you're using like really seriously strong rootstocks. So I want to plant full-size trees, but I also want to have annuals, and I don't want the annuals to not have enough sunshine. So pruning each tree to like 3 or 4 liters in like a vase shape, and then planting annuals underneath them. So I immediately started getting a yield. I had potatoes first, and I pulled out potatoes. As the trees are coming out of dormancy and starting to grow, the potatoes were pretty much coming out of the ground. And then plant something else in there. Like, put in okra in between them. And then if the okra starts to get too tall, I don't really care. I'll chop the tops of the okra off and I'll throw it down to the peach tree. If this peach branch was going too much over where I want to grow sweet potatoes, I'll just lop that branch off and drop it on the ground. And so you're getting the benefits of the chop and drop food forest. You're getting the benefits of an annual garden, and you have a resilient system because you haven't thrown all of your eggs into one basket. You have a whole huge amount of different crops. Like I have, I think, 5 or 6 different calorie root crops growing in these 6 grocery row garden beds that I have in my backyard right now. And though I developed the system in the tropics originally, I was really excited when basically during the pandemic and everything, we pretty much got booted out of the tropics. We lost what we had, and like, just like everything just got flipped upside down. I was like, oh my gosh, I got to go. You've got to leave right now. And so we got out and we got back to the States, and I got a piece of ground with the worst dirt that I have ever worked on. And I rebuilt the system. And now I like to have multiple years of testing into the system before I really get into, you know, how it works. But people are like, could you write a book? And I'm like, okay, I wrote this little book on it. This is what I did. And this book is like, this is what I did so far. Why don't you experiment with it? This is an open source system, mm-hmm. right? So most of the time, instead of coming across, people like assume, well, you're like the super expert on stuff. Yeah, well, I'm an expert on some stuff. But in the world of all knowledge, if you were to draw a circle representing all knowledge, I have a tiny pinprick of knowledge in this big circle of all knowledge. This is what's worked for me so far. This is what I've taken a huge amount of systems and played with them all and thrown them down and then reduced them and experimented. This is the system I'm experimenting with right now. Do you want to join me? Here's my little booklet explaining what I did and why I think it works so well and the theory behind it and all of the different people that inspired me to do it. I'm not coming out of nowhere and saying, this is my complete 1000% original system. I actually did a video called This Gardening System is 1000% Original, because I kind of get tired of that. This is the most amazing system that you've never seen before, and it just wholly formed out of nowhere. I freely give credit to a bunch of people that are as smart as me or smarter than me that I have learned from on the system, but it's bits and pieces of everybody's different tools, and now I've tested it in 2 climates, and I've got people that are planning test gardens in different climates to see if this overlaying of a pruned orchard where you basically go down these 3-foot rows and you go shopping, you pick your fruits, you pick your herbs, you pick your vegetables, you have space for animal life, you have basically a no-till system on the rows. I hoe the ground in between the rows. I just like run a wheel hoe down there to clean it up, because trying to get enough wood chips to cover that kind of an area is a pain in the neck. I don't really like bothering with it. People kept saying, how did you do it? How did you do it? How did you do it? And I realized people want me to tell them, all right, okay, so I've explained it, but I will write it down and I will sell a book on it. And the money that comes into that, I will just roll around in. No, I will buy a guitar. But I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to put it out there. So I just put it out there, and this is my preliminary book. And after maybe like 2 or 3 more years, I'll probably do a real like fat second edition where I have a bunch more data, because we're not deep enough in on the perennials. I know I'm getting great yields. I mean, we're experimenting with biochar and alfalfa pellets and all these other things to like improve the soil in this horrible area. But we don't know how it's going to work out in 3 years or 4 years. Are those pears going to start fighting? Am I not going to be able to put potatoes in there? Well, that's a data point. I need to know, am I going to have too much fighting in those systems? Am I going to have to cut the density down? I don't really mind doing that. I love chopping the density down and stuff, but I don't see any agricultural system as really a finished system anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, they're all experiments in the running. Yeah, and this is why we're, you know, that was awesome. There's a lot of information you crammed into there, and also sort of at the meta level, like, was this idea of it's always an experiment, and that's why we're saying you throw away the dogma. You learn what you can from as much, you know, of these different methods as you can and read about. But when you go out and you try and again, when you're in this, you know, survival garden scenario we're talking about right now, I would again say, look at your neighbors who already have gardens, see what's working for them and copy it. If that's, you know, get started somehow. And then as you bring a playful kind of attitude towards it. The more you work with plants, you can't help it. And yeah, plus it's just fun. And so things evolve, and you'll observe something is working or not working where you are, and maybe it's the rocks and the soil, who knows? And things will evolve. I like that way of saying it. It's a living system, and it's going to grow with you.
Right, and you're gonna find things that you don't like. Like, don't do stuff that you don't like, as much as possible. I mean, if you have to do things you don't like, right? You may not like digging. You know it's good for you, so you make yourself do it. You know, like, it's good to go to the gym and make yourself do it. But if you find yourself irritated and not getting joy out of growing the plants, I almost feel like the plants know it.
Oh, yeah.
They almost seem to respond. You know, there's always that one person, and they say, oh, she could stick a broomstick in the ground and it would sprout. And it's like, yeah, I've met people like that. But you should be seeking joy in it, too. Look, if you really like to grow hot peppers, but you also want a survival garden, you don't have to give up growing hot peppers. Somebody has to make pepper sprays for the riots. You know? Find a niche.
There's anti-inflammatory benefits to them as well. That's how I justify it. But
anti-inflammatory. That's it. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Not just weapons grade. We have thrown out a tremendous amount of knowledge, and I really appreciate your time. Is there any parting thoughts that you would want to throw in as we conclude here?
Yeah. Don't be overcome by fear, and don't be overcome by analysis paralysis. Don't be afraid to fail. What you want to do is you want to fail fast. You want to try a bunch of stuff and figure out what works and what doesn't work, and then keep pushing through and keep going. Our life is but a vapor. We have a short period of time here before we go to the other side, and we just need to do the very best that we can with the resources that we have. Love your family, build good communities around you. Don't lie to yourself and say that you're going to, you know, I'm doing a great job when you know you're not doing a great job. Just go the extra mile and push through the thing you need to do. If you're not in shape, get yourself in shape. If you eat garbage food when it hits 10 o'clock at night and you always find yourself going and getting ice cream, stop doing that. Get it out of your house. Get your life together and pull yourself up. And so you're in good shape to go to your garden. You're in good shape to take care of your family and take care of yourself. And whatever that thing is that you really, really wish that you had done in 2022, you wish that you had gardened like this or tried this or started doing this or written a book or whatever, don't let all the fear of the pandemic and all this stuff eat your life. You know, get it done. Just go do it and don't get chewed up. I mean, I believe that there's a plan. People always talk about there's all these evil conspiracies and everything. We absolutely know that that's true. But I believe that I'm on the winning side. Ultimately, I believe that God has a plan that's beyond all of this stuff, and that the certain amount of pain that we go through is actually sometimes a nudge to, hey, why don't you go find the guy that made this system and ask him what's going on? Hey, up here, you know. So don't let yourself get completely snowplowed, you know, because you could watch videos on the end of the world forever and ever, and it does not help you. Go out, pick up a shovel, and start digging and start planting, and pay attention to what, you know, Christian is saying and what other people are saying. Like, you need to go out and do it, but don't just absorb information and don't try it. Don't be afraid to fail. Go out and fail really awesomely. And then fail again, and then fail again, until you get that thing, and you're like, this system finally works, because that's the way you get it. You keep trying keys until you find the one that fits the lock that's your soil. And definitely, like Christian said, go talk to the old folks down the road. Go talk to anybody that's local and say, hey, how do you do this? And be friendly. If you've got a package of seeds and you can't plant all of those seeds, go to your neighbor and say, dude, I'm trying these pumpkins. You want to try some too? And give him some too. And you'll find that these connections start to come together, and you'll find that the more that you serve other people and the more you just go out and do physical work and push through all of the confusion and everything else, the better you feel, and the more the fear will just start to recede, and you realize, hey, we're not in control of everything, but I'm in control of how I can behave right now and what I can do. And I think I got it. I think we're good.
So. Fantastic. That's great advice. David the Good, thank you so much for your time. Is davidthegood.com the best place for people to find you and support your work?
No, thesurvivalgardener.com. The Survival Gardener is my main website, thesurvivalgardener.com. You can find me on YouTube as well as David the Good. I have a moderately entertaining channel. It's not YouTube is inherently a rhetorical medium. So sometimes you'll find that you read my book and you're like, oh, there's a lot of scientific information in there. And then on YouTube, I'm doing something absolutely ridiculous. Just roll with it. It's YouTube. You know, I really enjoy having fun on the YouTube channel, but you will see a lot of, you'll see beneath the surface and see I have a lot of complicated and interesting agricultural stuff going on, but we joke around a lot too. So we keep it entertaining, and you're welcome to join me. And it is a family friendly channel. So if your kids are interested in agriculture, they can totally watch my channel, and it's only occasionally terrifying.
No, it's a great channel. People should definitely go subscribe if you've not already seen David the Good. And there's also some guitar in there for the music aficionados. So thanks, David. Thanks once again. And take care.
Yeah, thank you, man. Glad to be here.